Half a league onward, all in the valley of death rode the 600. Forward, the light brigade, charge for the guns, he said. Into the valley of death rode the 600. Forward, the light brigade. Was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldier knew someone had blundered. There's not to make reply, there's not to reason why. There's but to do and die. Into the valley of death rode the 600. Cannon to right of them, cannon to left of them, cannon in front of them, volleyed and thundered. Stormed at with shot and shell, boldly they rode and well. Into the jaws of death, into the mouth of hell rode the 600. How many of you were forced to memorize that in high school? Anybody else? A few of us. That a very famous poem describes the infamous charge of the Light Brigade. During the Crimean War, that cavalry unit of 600 men with swords and lances charged the main body of the Russian army. And the Russian infantry was armed with guns and supported with artillery of cannons and mortars. And the Light Brigade charged the Russian forces because either the army's commanding officer was confused, or someone down the line misunderstood the command. History is not really certain on that. But instead of attacking a smaller force as expected, the Light Brigade assaulted the main body of the Russian army. And this disastrous attack led to the death of 110 of the cavalrymen and the injury of another 160, so that nearly half the brigade became casualties of a terrible miscommunication. We know the confusion of battle causes many good plans to go astray. But a wise general does all he can to minimize the risk. So a good general discovers the strength and the position of the opposing force before engaging them in battle. He does not attack first and then hope to figure things out as he goes. Rather, he sends out scouts and spies to get as much information as possible before he commits to a plan of action. And Jesus requires all who would follow him to do the same thing. Luke 14, verse 25. It says, "Now great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, in his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, "This man began to build and was not able to finish." Or what king, going to make war against another king, does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. So Luke 14 begins in the house of a Pharisee, where Jesus healed a man, and then he taught the parables of the shamed guest and the great supper. In verse 25, the scene shifts. Jesus is now outside the house in an unnamed location where he is surrounded by a large crowd. And Jesus turned to the crowd and did something incredibly strange to us. Jesus challenged the crowd following him to consider what being his disciple would cost him. What Jesus did is he turned around and he discouraged the multitudes from following him. And this is not the first or the only time that Jesus does this. This kind of discouraging teaching was repeated on multiple occasions. In John chapter 6, Jesus rebuked the crowd for following him, even though they had traveled a long distance that morning to find him. He rebuked them because they did not believe him. They just wanted more bread. Three other times in the Gospels, Jesus instructed people to take up their cross and follow him. Three more times, Jesus connected following him to losing one's life. And Jesus required his disciples to forsake everything to follow him. So when someone came to him that was reluctant to give up a particular thing, Jesus required that person to give up that thing before he could be Jesus' disciple. And Jesus never once described following him as a way to have a better life or to have your desires gratified. Jesus insisted that following him is costly and painful. Now, before we get into these parables, I do want to make just one additional comment about what's happening in these verses. Because as I've said, Jesus is very definitely speaking in such a way that some will leave. He is intending to discourage, not that he wants them all to leave, but that those who are not serious followers of him, he does not want to stay there and act as if they are. And we live in an age of marketing the church. We live in an age which attempts to make the church more appealing to the unsaved and very intentionally shapes church services to make the lost feel more comfortable. So that churches maximize the musical performances, the coffee options, the felt needs of the congregation, and the coolness of the preacher. The church, many churches minimize the preaching of the word, the rebuke of sin, the call to discipleship, and the need for holiness. So that it is not at all uncommon to find a 20-minute Bible-y motivational message taking the place of the reading, explanation, and application of Scripture. And we find this because our culture does not have the patience or desire to listen to a sustained explanation of truth and then a forceful application of that truth to their own life. So American Christianity is bent on making church attendance for the unsaved as easy and pleasant as possible. And American Christianity has gone to great lengths to remove the cost from Christianity. And in doing so, American Christianity has failed to consider the significance of passages like this one. They failed to consider Christ's call to sacrificial discipleship. Jesus was far more concerned with the devotion of his disciples than he was with having a large number of disciples. He was not motivated by drawing a crowd, but rather he drove thousands away because he would not give support, even silent support, to those who valued their own desires more than they valued him. And instead of quietly accepting a large group of double-minded followers, Jesus turned to them and issued the challenge. The challenge is this: to be Jesus' disciple, Jesus must be more important to you than anything else. Now, if you read the passage, and you remember what we read, Jesus doesn't say that. Rather, Jesus states this challenge in the strongest possible terms, terms which require everyone to consider honestly how much they love Jesus. Anybody can profess to love Jesus. Anybody can profess to love Jesus most. But what matters is what you do. It's not what you say. And so in verse 26, Jesus says, if you would be his disciple, you must hate your father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters and your own life. That is the call that he gives. Now, I need to explain what he's saying. But in doing so, I do not want to lessen in any way the force of his words. I'm afraid that as we understand the passage, we're tempted to step back from its forcefulness. But Jesus is truly saying that your relationship with him must be the supreme relationship in your life. No one, nobody should be more important to you than him. And what Jesus is doing in verse 26 is he's speaking in hyperbole. He's making intentionally exaggerated statements, not to mislead, but to make his point. So Jesus is not literally saying that to follow him, you must despise your whole family. That would be, and it really would be the wrong interpretation to say, well, I'm a Christian now, I hate you. We know this for a lot of reasons. We are commanded to love others, to love other ones. Jesus himself commanded us to love others. We have examples in the New Testament of faithful disciples who cared for their family. We know that Peter, other disciples, and James and Jude were married, and they took their wives with them as they traveled preaching the gospel. 1 Corinthians 7 commands believing spouses to not leave their unbelieving husband. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, we are told that the man who does not meet the physical needs of his family is worse than an unbeliever. All of these passages require us to continue to love our family after salvation. So we cannot understand these words in a strict literal sense. We understand them as figurative speech to impress on us the importance of this command. Now, while these are not a strict literal command for every Christian, the history of the church has revealed thousands upon thousands of times when a person has had to turn his back on all his family to follow Jesus. So though in history, believers have been kicked out of their homes, divorced, stripped of their parental rights, and disowned by their families because of their faith in Jesus. Believers have left parents and siblings behind to travel to distant lands where any communication with home is incredibly difficult, in some cases nearly impossible. Even as recently as the 70s, a letter from a missionary in Africa would take 3 weeks to get to the States. And then any return letter, of course, would take another 3 weeks. A missionary like that would miss funerals, weddings, family reunions, all the other major events of family life. They leave those behind to follow Christ. And this verse challenges us to ask and honestly answer, is Jesus that important to you? Will you follow him no matter what obeying him does to your family relationship? And the one who loves family more than obedience to Christ cannot be his disciple. The one who loves his own life more than Jesus will not be his disciple. He stresses that at the end of verse 26, and his own life also. Those who are not willing to risk personal loss, to risk their health or their freedom, or even their own life, those who are not willing to risk their own personal desires cannot be a disciple of Jesus. I know we do not live in a place where our life is threatened because we are Christians. Yet all around the world today, people are faced with a choice. They can follow Jesus or they can live. They can follow Jesus or they could have freedom. Many have to choose between torture or abuse and Jesus. And the one who is not willing to suffer, to hurt, to die for Jesus will not be his disciple. Then verse 27, Jesus says, whoever does not bear his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Now, contrary to the popular use of this phrase, the cross Jesus calls you to carry is not a heavy burden in your life. The cross he calls you to carry is not a trial that you're going through. The cross he calls you to carry is not a troublesome person that you have to deal with. We all know that the cross was an instrument of execution. The cross was the electric chair, the needle, the noose, the guillotine. Usually a person only carried a cross once in his life, when he was traveling from the place of judgment to the place of execution. The one carrying the cross was walking down death row to the gas chamber. The one carrying his cross was taking the final journey of his life. And so to carry your cross is to walk toward your own death. And with these words in verse 27, Jesus is emphasizing again that final point of verse 26. If you're not willing to lose your life for Jesus' sake, then you cannot be his disciple. If you're not willing to follow him and to carry your death on your shoulders, you cannot be his disciple. The Christian life is a life of death. For millions, it has been a life of literal physical death. For every one of us, it is a life of death to self. It is a life of dying daily. That is what Paul meant in Galatians 2:20 when he said, I am crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. That's what Paul meant in Romans 6 when he said that as many of us as were baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death, and our old man was crucified with him, that the body of sin might be done away with. In short, at salvation, we die with Christ. And we are to live daily in that death. So the Christian life is a life of constant death to self, in which we live as sacrifices to God. So that if you would follow Jesus, you must love him more than any person, including yourself. You must love him more than your own life. And that brings us to these two parables that we're considering today. Because if you think you want to follow Jesus, you must consider first what it will cost you. So verse 28, he says, which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? And in Jesus' day, the owner of a vineyard would build a watchtower in the middle of his field. And from there, he could keep watch over the crops to protect them from bandits or wild animals. And so what landowner would build a tower, would start to build a tower without at first getting a cost estimate and then examining his own funds to determine if he can afford the work? I mean, any reasonable landowner would sit down first with all the necessary information, crunch all the numbers to ensure he can afford to finish the project. We just did this floor. People are still talking about a brand new floor this morning. We just finished that. But we began planning to replace those floor coverings several years ago. We saved up until we thought we had enough money, and then we went out and we requested quotes from contractors to determine if we could afford to put new floors in. How silly would it have been if we had hired somebody and said, come in and do the floors, and about the time they got done tearing up all the old carpet, we realized that we didn't have enough money to put the new floor down. It would have been absolutely ridiculous. We would have rightly chided for our bad planning. In Jesus' day, if somebody began to build a tower but ran out of money, he would be mocked. That's what Jesus says at the end of verse 29, all who see it begin to mock him. Again, this is more. Remember, this is an honor-shame culture. This is more than just, you know, making fun of him, laughing at his expense. This would have had social consequences. He would have lost face. He would have brought shame on himself and his family by his poor planning. So his failure to consider the cost would have had significant consequences. The second parable communicates the same thing as the first. And now Jesus uses the example of a king. What king going to make war against another king does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? So what king on the way to battle, he sees the other king coming, what king does not first send out spies and scouts to determine, are my forces able to defeat the enemy? What king does not first sit down with his maps and charts and rosters to see if he can win the war or if he needs to send ambassadors to seek peace? A foolish king who did not prepare wisely for battle would suffer the loss of his army and loss of many of his men. He would suffer the loss of his kingdom and very likely the loss of his own life. Failure to consider the cost before engaging battle would be disastrous. So Jesus tells us the same thing twice. He says, count the cost, consider. And by saying the same thing in these two different parables, he's emphasizing the importance of these truths. Jesus wanted the crowds to understand what he was saying. He wanted them to gather, to understand the weight of it. But from these two parables, Jesus makes a single application. Verse 33, so likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. So what's going on in verse 33 is it is the closing application. Jesus is summing up what he said before the parables in verses 26 and 27. He is now directly applying the parables and saying, this is what you need to consider. If you would follow Christ, you must count the cost. The cost is you must love nothing more than Jesus. So the call to follow Jesus is not a call to a life of ease and comfort. The call to follow Jesus is a call to forsake everything for him. And this cost of following Jesus is relational, it's personal, and it's material. So to follow Jesus, he must be more important to us than anyone else. To follow Jesus, he must be more important to us than our own lives. To follow Jesus, he must be more important to us than any of our possessions or all of our possessions. So is there anything in your life you could not give up if Jesus required it of you? Is there anyone in your life who could persuade you to turn from Jesus? What would it take to cause you to turn away? And what Jesus says is there must be nothing, nothing more important, nothing that holds a greater influence in our life. The call of discipleship is a call to be willing to lose anyone or anything but Jesus. To say this in another way, you must love him with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. You must love him with every fiber of your being. You must love him more than anyone or anything. And you must not love him only in your words. You must love him in your actions, in your day-to-day decisions, so that each day you are forsaking everything which keeps you from drawing closer to him. Now, we must not understand these verses to be teaching us that total commitment is necessary before salvation. No one is ever saved by abandoning everything to follow Jesus. No, Jesus does not require you to abandon everything before you can be saved. Jesus does not require you to commit to abandoning everything before you can be saved. He does say count the cost, because this will be required. But that is all following salvation. Salvation is entirely the work of Jesus received by you through faith and faith alone. Not by devotion or forsaking things, but by faith in Him. And this work of discipleship comes after salvation. It's not an optional work. Now, just because it follows salvation doesn't mean you can decide whether or not you want to do it. It is required of you. And if you are saved, you are now the servant of God. You are now the disciple of Christ. You are required to love Jesus more than all else. And then verses 34 and 35, Jesus talks about salt. And at first glance, this seems a little bit random. In fact, if your Bible has headings in it like mine does, you might have a new heading over these two verses that separate it from the ones before. I don't think they're separate. And I know we read verse 34 and it should echo in our mind the Sermon on the Mount, you are the salt of the earth. But this is not just a random proverb that Luke dropped in here because he couldn't figure out where else to put it. This is directly related to what is going on before. These are Jesus' words continuing this subject. He's not changing the subject to give us some cryptic statement. He's continuing on the same theme. This reference to salt, therefore, is part of this idea of discipleship. We know that from the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus used salt to describe His followers, and He does the same here. What He's doing here is warning us against bland and weak discipleship. He says, salt is good, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? Ultimately, what He says, salt which has lost its flavor is useless. Now, verse 35, He talks about throwing it on the land or the dunghill. It indicates here that this is a salt used for fertilizing. This is not talking about table salt. This is talking about a particular salt, which today we call a potassium salt. It was found all around the Dead Sea. In fact, it's still mined from the Dead Sea. We also call this today potash. It's a salt which contains potassium chloride. It can be eaten. In fact, that's why He's talking about it losing its flavor. It can be even eaten. It's used today as a substitute for regular salt, sodium chloride. But it was also used, and its primary use even today, is as a fertilizer. So that by spreading potash on the field, it introduces back into the field vital potassium and sometimes other minerals. By spreading the potash on a pile of manure, it injects and puts the same minerals and potassium into the manure, which is then, of course, spread on the field, as a fertilizer. However, if the salt has lost its flavor, if its minerals have leached out of it, it is weak and useless. Flavorless salt cannot add taste to food, and it cannot add nutrients to the ground. Jesus says that is good for nothing but for men to throw it out. It just has to be thrown in the garbage. And the flavorless disciple is one who has lost his distinctiveness, that which makes him truly a disciple. This flavorless disciple is ultimately good for nothing. He is a tasteless salt. He is nutrient-free fertilizer. He's lost all. It makes him distinctive. What is it that makes Christianity distinctive? What is it that makes you as a Christian different from all of the unsaved? What gives Christianity its unique flavor? Now, maybe we should first ask, should a Christian be distinguished from everybody else? Is that actually a requirement of us that we be different? Obviously, this passage implies that. The biblical answer elsewhere is a resounding yes. Ephesians 4:17 says you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk, so that you who are saved should not live like the unsaved do. You should not live like you did before you were saved. In Ephesians 4 and Colossians 3, we are told to put off the old way of living and to put on a new Christ-imitating lifestyle. Romans 12 verse 2 says very simply, do not be conformed to this world. We must be different. Something about us should distinguish us from the rest of the world. What is that? What makes us different? Is it how we spend our time on Sunday morning? Is it your kindness and your charitable giving? Is it how you talk about others? Is it about the words that you don't say? Is it how you vote? What is it that makes a Christian distinct? The answer that Jesus gives is that what makes us different from the rest of the world is absolute sacrificial devotion to Him. The distinctive flavor of the Christian life is a love for Jesus which surpasses all other loves. This is a love which changes how we live, and it affects everything we do. Now, I know I've been talking in big terms. You might be thinking about, well, do I need to go on the mission field? Is that what he's saying? He's trying to get me to sell everything and go live in a monastery somewhere. It's actually not what this passage calls us to do. The question it calls us to really ask is, what does it look like today to love Christ more than family, more than life, more than self, and more than possessions? What does it look like to be completely devoted to Jesus while you go to work every morning, while you go shopping, while you clean your house, while you visit with your neighbors, while you sit on the beach, or even while you watch TV? Is there a uniquely Christian way that we can watch TV? Now, time does not permit me to explain this thoroughly. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the principle, the foundational principle, and then I'm going to give you just one example of what it looks like. If you love Jesus most, you'll do everything as if whatever you are doing is for the Lord Himself. So the primary aim and desire will be His approval of your action. So the principle is this: supreme love for Jesus makes His pleasure your greatest desire in anything you do. Supreme love for Jesus makes His pleasure your greatest desire in anything you do. That's the principle. One example of how this works out is how it changes our family relationships. So that in the family, this supreme love for Jesus looks like wives submitting to their own husbands in the manner which is appropriate in Christ. So to be a wife who loves Jesus above self, husband, and children is to be a wife whose relationship to her husband is one of humble submission. In the family, this supreme love for Jesus looks like husbands who love their wives and do not say hurtful things to them. So to be a husband who loves Jesus above self, wife, and children is to be a husband who humbly serves his wife and lovingly speaks kindly to her. In the family, this looks like children who are obedient to their parents. So to be a child who loves Jesus above self, above mom, above dad, is to be a child who humbly obeys his parents in all things. In the family, this looks like a dad who disciplines his children with carefulness, lest they become brokenhearted by his correction. So to be a parent who loves Jesus above self, spouse, and children is to lovingly train your children in a way that encourages them to continue in the right. That's just one setting, four distinct applications of it. A life which loves Jesus most is a practical life. This supreme love for Jesus affects the most basic things and the most familiar of relationships. So the principle of doing all for the Lord, it applies to our work, to our conversations, to our entertainment, our relationships with our neighbors, our participation in politics, our gatherings with believers, our study of the Word, our prayer to God, our service to others, and every other aspect of our life. This is an all-encompassing principle. And it is fleshed out in your daily life by making Jesus' opinion of your thoughts, words, and deeds the most important opinion in the world. So Jesus requires we be ready to lose family, life, and every other thing to follow Him. And doing anything less is unacceptable.